This week on Lunchbox Envy. In America, it's sometimes marketed as variety meat.
In Elizabethan times, it was used as a special effect for the gory deaths in Shakespeare's plays.
And in the 1920s, a fraudulent psychic known as Marjorie allegedly placed it inside her intimate areas to give the impression that she was exuding ectoplasm.
Oh, it's awful! And welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Manu, and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Jack. How you doing, Jack?
I'm doing well, thanks. I'm actually not here with you. I'm in South Africa, which is why we're recording this remotely. And it also gives us the opportunity to record with a friend of the podcast, the esteemed food historian, author, and broadcaster, Ken Albala. Hello, Ken.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a bit about what you do?
Yeah, I'm a food historian in Stockton, California, at the University of the Pacific. And that often involves cooking historic dishes to see what they taste like.
I love it. And what's, do you think, the most memorable thing that you've cooked thus far?
Ooh, moose nose jelly comes close.
That was,
I had a whole moose's head. And that was, I did that right in the backyard here.
Amazing.
A bear's butt was pretty good too, although that was really delicious.
Do these take a lot of preparation?
The moose nose, yes, because you have to cut it off and then cook it for a long time so that it gelatinizes. And, you know, at the end of this whole thing, it was actually for a TV show in the U.S. And at the end of this, they took a fork full of it and there was a big hair sticking out of it. And so, you know, this was the show was canceled and I don't know why.
How big was this nose? Because in my head, moose is like...
Yeah, the head was about 200 pounds. So, yeah, the nose came off and it was, you know, it was, I don't know, a few feet long. It was pretty big.
That leads perfectly into our topic. Buckle up, listeners. This episode contains a lot of squidge and blood and oozy goozy bits. Just maybe don't be eating whilst you're listening to this one. So, offal, what is it?
It's quite hard to define. Basically, it's meat, but it's all the parts of the animal that we tend not to enjoy eating, or at least traditionally.
The gelatinous bits, the like crunchy bits, the noses, the tails, the like organs, the entrails, the visceral.
So, for instance, you'll have heard of some of these from biology lessons: liver, kidneys, heart, tongue, brain. But then there's some stranger ones like sweetbreads. And gizzards and fish roe, in fact, which is the eggs of fish.
Eggs offal as well.
Well, fish eggs are, I think, yeah. But I think a lot of countries have different definitions of offal because to many cultures, the idea of eating spleen, for instance, is very sort of rudimentary and everyday. It's a cultural definition as much as a gastronomical one or an anatomical one.
I'm still not sure what a spleen is when it's in a living body.
It's delicious, Manny. That's all you need to know.
Do you want to talk a bit about where does the word come from?
Well, if you hang up an animal and you cut it open, you want the stuff to fall off, the organs, before you start cutting the meat. So it's just anything that comes off, which is trachea all the way down to the intestines.
Yeah, literally off all. I read that 39 million tons of offal is thrown away each year worldwide, which is a lot. And it's known as the fifth quarter by Italian butchers because they cut the animal into four quarters and then the remaining stuff, it actually weighs about as much as the other four quarters. So it kind of works on many different levels.
Okay, so what is this weird and wonderful food's history?
Well, it's certainly prehistoric. You know, since we've been humans, we've been eating animals and eating the guts in the animals. And if you look at the very earliest recipes, there's guts everywhere. You know, people clearly had no aversion to eating those parts. And it's really just a modern phenomenon. I mean, you know, even a very elegant cookbook up into the 19th century would have included every single part of the animal and not even thought of it as poor people's food at all. You know, sometimes exactly the opposite. The tongue, for example, was the best part. If you think of as people were moving west in across the prairies, they shot the buffalo, or the bison is the technically correct term. They would just take the tongues and leave the rest of the whole animal.
Wow.
Which is horrifying, but, you know, because they obviously almost drove them to extinction. But that switch really just comes with modernity. They comes with people not being connected to animals, not living around them, not understanding that they have to be killed in order to eat them. And this idea that meat shows up in the supermarket in a little plastic tray wrapped in cellophane, and that's what meat is. And we even have different words. One of the fascinating thing I find is that in English, there's a Saxon word for the animal, a pig, and a Norman French word for the food, pork, chicken, poultry, cow, beef, you know, and that helps us to distance ourselves from the animal. And I think that's really a shame, because I think the more people understand where their food comes from, the more likely they are to care for those animals well, and the more likely they are to not waste any part of them. And I think that's the biggest shame about this, not just because they taste good and they're fun to cook with and eat, but it's that we throw away like a third of the animal just because we want muscle meat. That's sad.
Now, I read that the largest purchaser of lamb's hearts or sheep hearts in the UK are schools, because they just use it for science lessons for dissection.
Well, let's hope we can change their minds.
Yeah.
So I found some of the earliest evidence we have of offal eating was found in human, I can never say this right, human coprolite?
Coprolites, yeah.
So fossilized poo from, Jack, the same people that left the pig waste around Stonehenge.
Oh, no way.
It's about 4,500 years old around the Durrington Walls, which is just outside of Stonehenge. Nice. And they found the fossilized eggs of tiny parasitic worms that could only have been eaten in raw or undercooked meats, particularly lungs or liver. So it's really obvious that we've been eating all sorts of parts of animals for a really, really long time.
Often they will examine the rims of pots, clay shards and pots, and the fat, which is boiling on the top of the pot, actually stays in the surface of the unglazed pot. So they can tell that bones were broken open from marrow and that all sorts of organs were cooked, and kind of reconstruct a prehistoric diet based on the fat residues, which is kind of cool.
That's really cool. Do you ever read about these older kind of prehistoric diets and get excited to be like, I would, you know what? I would do that. Sounds great.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I mean, when you see historic recipes there, it's kind of like traveling to a, you know, another place and seeing exciting ingredients and things. And as long as you can get the ingredients, then I say, you know, try it. If you're really trying to reconstruct the recipe and to see what people ate, the difficulty is some things you just cannot buy.
And do you inflict the recipes that you make on your friends and family? Do they get a veto?
I try to. I'm married to a vegetarian, so that doesn't work very often.
So it's time for our first lunchbox. And this week, it's you, Ken. What have you bought for us today?
I brought some haggis, which I made last night, which turned out really nice. My neighbors came over and ate it with me. But a haggis, you know, traditionally we associate with Scotland because that's where the classic chieftain of the pudding race comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a sheep's stomach that's stuffed with a mixture of oats and liver and organs, and most importantly, lungs. It's the what's called the lights, is the trachea and lungs. And, you know, I couldn't actually use lungs because you cannot buy lungs in the United States. They're illegal in the United States. And they have been since 1971, considered, to quote, unfit for human consumption, according to the USDA. And I think it's because of the way they slaughter the animal. They hang it upside down and all the blood drains through the lungs, and that makes it unfit for some reason.
Wow. So just in case our lawyer's listening, you haven't made this with lungs.
I didn't actually. Although people do, you know, if you raise the animal yourself or if you have some secret Scotsman on the side who can, you know, deliver it to you surreptitiously, that'll work.
I read that it's legal in Canada, so if you're quite near the border, you can just pop over and buy some.
Smuggle some.
I had a Scottish friend who used to wait on a corner in Berkeley, and she would get a handoff from this Scottish guy who made real haggis, like surreptitiously, you know, and serve it at Robbie Burns night.
Wow. That's amazing. So it's not, wait, what's the legality? You can't, presumably there's no market for it. It's like illegal to sell or import. But if you grow the animal yourself, that's a loophole.
Right. And you would have to butcher the animal yourself also.
I see.
And almost all of it is sent immediately to go into dog food. So,
oh, shame. Mm, well, you get some dog is good haggis flavored dog food.
Yes, it's delicious. But I made a haggis last night and included pretty much everything that would go into it, except for the lights, as they're called politely, trachea and lungs and everything. Oh. And I've eaten them many times. I mean, they're really quite delicious. They serve them in Italy sometimes with artichokes stewed. In Austria, they have a Beuschel, which is this lovely, rich stew made out of lungs. So there's nothing inherently bad about it. It's very dark. It's a spongy kind of meat. And I think if you've ever had haggis, you'll know that sort of dark color and texture comes from the lungs. But the one that I brought is pretty close. It's just, you know, it's Ooh. Just oats and suet and liver and some onions and a lot of pepper. So it's really tastes great, I think. But the funniest thing about haggis is we really associate it with Scotland very closely because of Robbie Burns and the, you know, chieftain of the pudding race. But It's the oldest recipes are English. They go back to the Middle Ages in England.
Also, just for people that don't know the kind of Burns Night and haggis connection.
An American audience will not understand that at all, because pudding to us means a chocolate pudding, tapioca, rice pudding. Yeah. The whole idea of putting grains or flour or breadcrumbs or something like that and meat in a stomach and boiling it, that's completely and utterly unknown in the US. Even the word pudding, you know, which comes from boudin, it just means, you know, sausage.
Oh, that's so cool. How do you fasten the stomach as well, like apart from all of the amazing cuts that go in it, how do you stuff
well
it?
there's a one of the stomachs on a ruminant is called the cecum. And it's a cul-de-sac, meaning it only has one entrance. The food goes in there, ferments, if you can imagine a bloated cow, and it lets off the gas, and then it goes out the same way. So all you really have to do is, it's a big bag. You put all the contents in there, sew up one end and boil it, and you get a haggis.
Voila. I often see vegetarian haggis around this time of year. There's lots of haggis in supermarkets.
I learned a new word just this morning, which is apparently if you make it out of vegetables, you call it a vagus, which doesn't sound good to me.
Nope.
This is great.
Absolutely not. Okay, so haggis is obviously an awfully, awfully dish for the had to slip it in once.
We've got there.
But there are so many different types and cuts of meat that are also considered offal. Should we have a look at some of those?
Oh yeah, let's jump in.
Sweetbread.
I know it as the thyroid gland, which I think is
thymus. It's the thymus, not the thyroid. Yeah.
And then also the pancreas, I think, can be a sweetbread.
Okay. And the word apparently bread means meat in Middle English. So it's so that's the etymology. It makes no sense, though.
But also the sweet bit, originally, I think it meant pleasant or nice. It didn't necessarily mean sugary. Yeah.
The funny thing is that people think it's going to be a really strong, you know, unpleasant, stinky flavor. It's so delicate and very light and delicious.
But it's also because it's from younger cattle animals, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Confusingly, sweet meat is actually a sweet. Like an OG sugary treat. Nothing to do with meat.
Oh, well, she's often made
meat. Meat in English just means food. Like what do you have for your meat? It just means in general food.
And then we have gizzard, which is another one that I'd heard a lot and didn't actually know what that meant, which is the muscular part of a bird's stomach that helps break its food down with the aid of stones often, which is mad. Yeah, so they'll like eat rocks and it goes into this really chunky, thick part of the stomach and it kind of acts like a mill, which helps break their food down. And that, we've decided, is another tasty bit to eat. And so that is...
It is, actually.
Is it?
But if you've ever like caught a wild duck, it's right up here. It's underneath their neck. And I've clean ducks and found them full of corn, you know, just because they gorge themselves. But it does kind of grind everything up before it goes down.
So then there are also giblets, which is a plural term for poultry offal in general. So, you know, when you buy a chicken or a turkey and you get that bag, that's all of the innardy bits, which includes gizzards. And then sometimes like the neck muscle for some reason. Ken, do you know why they love the neck muscle in the giblet bag?
It's because it has a lot of connective tissue. And when you make a stock, it's going to give it that rich gelatinous kind of texture. Mm. So the neck is always included. Ah. And if they were to leave it on, you'd have this long thing extending off the bird and it wouldn't fit in the pan. That's really all the only reason
they take it off. Oh, that's so clever. And then I think my favorite chicken or poultry offal part, the parson's nose.
I don't think that's considered awful, you know, because it stays on the bird and it's the prized piece. Really, it's almost complete fat, you know. My grandmother used to call it the culu, which means the tush in Spanish, actually.
One of the reasons I loved reading about the parson's nose so much, so that fatty end bit of the tail, is its function in a live bird. I had no idea why it was so fatty, what it was for, and it's actually to waterproof, say, the chicken, if we're talking about chickens. So they have a little gland at the top of their butt.
Are we talking glands again?
The top bit of their butt, it's like under their feathers, which they can kind of lift up, and they'll kind of bend over, crane their necks, rub their faces all over this gland, and it releases oils onto their face. Okay. And then they rub their heads over the rest of their feathers, and that's what's giving them that waterproof coating. Okay.
This is especially for ducks. And, you know, there's a wonderful anecdote. You remember the movie Dr. Doolittle? Well, apparently the ducks looked kind of dirty, so they washed them and they threw them into this fake pond that they had, and they sunk immediately, and everyone was rushing to try and save them, and most of them died, apparently.
Oh, no.
Which is terrible.
That's awful, because they weren't oily anymore.
That's
right.
Oh,
that's so depressing. So the parson's nose etymology, is that what I think it is? Because I've read that it's to do with taking the piss out of the clergy who are kind of quite up themselves, have their noses in the air, but also quite gluttonous and like...
I think so. And it's often called the Pope's nose also, because it has that sort of shape, you know, like an old man's nose would be, I guess.
Okay, cool. The last thing I have on the parson's nose, I've read, say, for like turkey consumption in the US, a lot of turkey tails are lobbed off and sent to other countries where they're a delicacy, because apparently there wasn't much of a demand for them in the US, even though the demand for turkey meat, especially around Thanksgiving dinners and stuff, was exploding. In the 1950s, a lot of American turkey farmers decided to send them to Samoa. And they've become like a national dish, to the extent that in 2007, when the government was trying to kind of control levels of obesity, and banned the import of turkey tails, it caused such an uproar they had to drop the ban, because they're like family food, national dish, speciality.
Yes, I've heard something similar with the nearby nation of Tonga, which has a similar problem. It gets a lot of the mutton flaps, in fact, so the belly of a sheep, and it's got a lot of fat in it, and they have a similar problem with obesity. So they've actually successfully banned it in 2020. It was a bit of a sort of neo-colonial thing that they were getting these imported from New Zealand, but actually New Zealand was taking all the nice cuts and then giving away the sort of cheaper bits to the islands without much money.
Well, I think we keep coming back to the fact that, say, one man's like delicacy and dream food is another person's disgusting, illegal, in some cases, waste product.
I was going to ask, what's your favorite offal that you've ever eaten?
I don't know. I'd have to say lungs, just because it's the most unusual one, and I have it very, very rarely. But it's got this lovely spongy texture. It's very dark. And yeah, I'd put that up there. Definitely.
Oh, amazing.
I still couldn't get my head around it, because it was a bit freaky, but I love the texture and flavor of tongue, beef tongue. So tender, delicious.
It's good. It's tasting you back, though.
That's the freaky thing. Time to move on to our second lunchbox. And today, that is mine. Today, I have bought a tin of dog food. Which you'll be glad you're not going to eat today. I think the whole point is that, unlike Ken's lunchbox, which he is not technically legally allowed to make with all of the ingredients in America, I could eat this if I wanted to. So Pet food is made with a lot of offal. So it tends to include loads of things like heart and liver and lungs. And it's also tested by humans.
So, you know, the amazing thing is that if an animal, a predator, kills another animal, the first thing they eat is the organs because they have the most vitamins, they're the most nutritious. The muscle meat is left for the last. So dogs know what they're doing, really.
Yeah. Well, does anyone have a pet killer whale? Because just down the coast from here, where I am now, there are two orcas have moved into the bay just next to Cape Town, South Africa. And they attack great white sharks. They zone in on one specific part. They suck out the liver, which actually can be up to 30% of the shark's body weight. And then they just sort of leave the shark to die. They don't eat any of the rest of it. They just love the liver. But they've learned. They're so clever.
It's so clever. Also, I get a bit annoyed when people give humans so much shit for being really wasteful in our food consumption.
Yeah, true.
And other animals in the kingdom.
We need to teach
the
orcas about food waste.
So I think in this case, it feels a bit less wasteful. This I got from a documentary by Channel 4, which was called Britain's Giant Pet Food Factory. So Mars owns a pet food factory in Melton.
Mars, as in who make the chocolate?
Candy?
Yes, exactly.
Oh my God.
So massive, massive company in this factory in Leicester. They produce Whiskers cat food and Pedigree dog food. So every morning, massive chunks of frozen liver, heart and kidney arrive on trucks. The meat is broken down into a mush. We love a meat mush. Then it's piped into long tubes. And then those tubes are cooked and then they're chunked. And those are the chunky little bits that you find in, say, like wet cat food. And then there's a section of the day, which is the tasting section. So someone rings a bell and everyone's like, okay, it's time. And they'll grab their pets, which they brought with them to work. And they go into like a boardroom and they'll have dog bowls of, say, food. They're doing a dog food testing. But then they also have human plates, which is very worrying. So everyone is trying the dog food to give it the thumbs up before it's shipped and sent away to be sold.
How do you teach a dog to use a knife and fork? I know they can play poker. I've seen a picture of that. So sorry, how do the humans judge whether it's tasty for a cat or a dog?
Dogs eat shit. I mean, so it's not like they're picky.
That is fair. You know, cats are really picky, though.
Yes.
Like, cats are weird with their food. Yeah.
And they're obligate carnivores, aren't they?
That is true. So, in the cat food, it's meat products, offal only, gravy and bits. In the dog food, there's a mixture of meats and vegetables because dogs are omnivorous. So one of the human taste testers in this documentary said, if I were to make a pie with this dog food and not tell you, you would not know. She says she much prefers dog food. And I think it's probably because it includes this mixture of ingredients. It's more omnivorous than the like straight
and
cat food.
Just to be clear, she prefers dog food to cat food rather than prefers dog food to human food.
Yes, I think that is implied.
I was going to ask.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah, starting with the idea of feeding offal to other animals, this kind of animal wastage. Part of the reason in the UK particularly we fell out of love with offal in quite recent history, and that's to do with mad cow disease. So in the early 1990s, there was an epidemic of bovine spongiform
encephalopathy.
Thank you. Or BSE for short. So I'm just going to call it BSE. We'd started calling it mad cow disease because of the way the disease works. So it attacks the nervous system and it affected the cow's ability to move and to function normally. And it also made them quite aggressive. So at its peak in 1992-93, it was estimated that about 180,000 cattle, so it wasn't just cows, it was also sheep, were infected with the disease. And it meant that about 4.4 million of these animals were killed. So it was a huge deal. Apparently tourism to the UK plummeted at the time because it could carry across to humans as well. So the human variant.
It's not an infectious disease, though. It actually comes from your eating the brain or spinal column of the animal. or feeding exactly. that to another cows, which is really the difficult ethical part of it. You know, is there yeah. feeding waste from one cow to another?
Yeah, so it was meat and bone meal that they were grinding up, like the offaly part. And I think giving to cows and other animals as a kind of like protein supplement. But what happened is, unfortunately, one of these cows that they ground down and fed its spinal cord and like brain tissue to other cows had something called a prion disease, which is gnarly. So it's basically like a really messed up protein in an infected animal that kind of works in the brain. And it convinces, we're still not entirely sure how, it convinces other proteins in the brain to kind of misfold and start contorting in a way that damages nerve cells within the brain. So much so that they start to die off and it leaves kind of sponge-like holes in your brain. So after, it takes quite a long time to develop, but after a while, your brain basically looks like it's got empty pockets in it and it's really spongy. And that's why you get all of these mad cognitive issues. The kind of mechanism of this disease was first discovered by researchers who are studying cannibalism in humans. So in the 1960s,
Kuru I is think. The disease. Yeah.
Exactly. Ken, do you know about Kuru disease?
Yeah, well, it was a ritual eating of the brains of the ancestors in order to incorporate their spirit and, you know, was done for a long time. But if someone has the prion disease of Jacob Creutzfeldt, it's the human form of that, then you catch it, totally.
Jacob Creutzfeldt, so they were part of that research team that discovered this kind of mechanism in people. What was really interesting about their study is they figured out how it was passing between people and like directly eating brain matter, because in these funeral rites, it was women who were doing a lot of the eating of the deceased loved ones. And it was particularly the brains that they were eating. And then once the women were done, sometimes the children were fed small parts of this brain tissue as like a snack or like a little tidbit. And it turned out that a lot of women and children were dying off from the disease in this community. So when these researchers found this community of people in Papua New Guinea, it was mostly older men and teenage boys that had survived. So interesting. So yeah, don't feed animal brains to other animals.
Yeah, and it's a shame because BSE is the reason we don't feed pigs food waste. Like, it's illegal to do in this country, even though I think BSE has been dormant or absent for 30 or so years, because otherwise that's the ultimate food waste solution, is turning the vegetable offal that we don't like to eat into like viable protein from a pig.
Yeah, the other shame is that brains are really very delicious. It's a very light, delicate white meat. And typically, I mean, there's no reason not to eat it apart from this disease.
You can eat animal brains now, can't you? Or is it illegal in the UK still? I'm pretty sure.
I think it is. I don't think it's illegal in the United States, but no one carries it at all.
Yeah. What brains have you eaten, Ken?
Yeah.
Well, I've eaten a whole lamb's brain, which was kind of off-putting because it was sitting on the plate, you know, just this whole brain.
Fully formed.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It wasn't sliced up or anything. Ooh. And you just cut into it and ate it. And it was fine taste-wise, but looked really strange.
How was it cooked? Was it boiled?
I don't know, honestly. Maybe baked. It didn't look browned at all.
That's intense.
But there are great recipes. I mean, brain recipes go back. Even the ancient Romans ate brains. There's one wonderful one in Apicius, which is made with rose petals and brains pounded up with eggs and made into like a tart. It sounds great.
Wow.
Yeah.
Apart from mad cow disease, really, really putting this country off offal eating, and in many cases, like making it illegal too. You talked about being presented with a brain, a chunk of meat that you know what that is. You look at it and you can relate to it. And that kind of reaction to offal, and there's no escape from what you're eating.
Yeah.
Like the yuck response, I think, is a massive part of why we're not eating offal, and something I think a lot of people are trying to change because it's really important that if we're going to continue to eat meat when our planet is in such a precarious state, like we can't afford to waste these parts.
Very resource intense, isn't it?
Yeah,
sure. So and if you think about the fact that if we did eat all the parts, we could raise half the amount of cattle, you know?
Yes, I saw a restaurant in Sheffield was serving heart, but they'd sliced it up and seared it. And it looked indistinguishable from steaks. And they've served it with some side dishes.
Heart is a pure muscle. So it tastes exactly like meat. And in fact, you can even slice it and eat it raw. It's delicious.
Really?
Wow. So you've eaten raw heart as well, Ken. Your back catalogue of foods you've tried is fantastic. So where's your line? Because I feel like you don't have one from this conversation.
So let me tell you, you know, when you get to what anthropologists call the threshold of repugnance, it means it brings you right up to that line. I think andouillette is really the line for me. I was in Paris with a friend, and it's basically pig's intestines stuffed into another intestine, and it smells like shit. I mean, there's just no way around that. About halfway through, I was just like, I can't do it anymore. It's just too much.
They've got names for all the four different parts of a cow's, I don't want to say stomach, because they're not stomachs, but they're sort of four chambers in the digestive tract. And they're lovely in French. They're called bonnet, caillette, feuillette, and pons.
And aussi, and the cul-de-sac, is c'est un autre.
Yes.
To be fair, we haven't really spoken about tripe, which is the lining of a cattle's stomach. And as Jack has said, because cows and cattle ruminants have these multiple stomach chambers, there are different types of tripe for each specific chamber. But the one I think of, I realized, is the second chamber, which is the reticulum tripe or honeycomb tripe, which is beautiful kind of like squiggly. And it takes so much preparation. Like, it's insane the amount of work that goes into making these kind of palatable for humans. So back in the day in the UK, tripe was a pretty popular dish, so much so that you had people called tripe dressers preparing the stomach lining. It must be quite big.
If you want to try tripe, though, they sell it already prepared, you know, already cleaned. And all you really do is slice it into little bits. But their recipes, like the Provençal tripe, is fantastic. It's tomatoes and garlic and peppers and things. And so is menudo, which is a soup made of tripe they have in Mexico, which is perfect hangover cure. But it's also really, really spicy and savory, and it doesn't smell like organ meat at all.
Sure.
Because does tripe have, apart from the kind of amazing texture, in my head, it wouldn't have the more like scatol poo smell of the andouillette, because it's not in that part of the digestive system.
It actually does.
So.
If you don't cook it correctly, it does. Yeah.
No.
Which is why you have these strong flavors with it. Because if you just boil it off, you know, just throw it in a pan and try to cook it, it smells pretty bad.
Because one of the things I saw people were eating it a lot with, especially up in the north of England, where it's, I think, still quite a popular snack, was a lot of salt and vinegar. So I'm imagining that would help mask the kind of poopier notes.
Yeah, I associate it with Lancashire. I don't know if that's unfair on the Lancastrians.
No, that's absolutely right. They at one point called it Lancashire calamari. I got sent an article by one of my good friends, another food historian called Jack Hanlon. At the time, in the 1950s and 60s, it was so popular that tripe sellers, particularly one called United Cattle Products Chain, it had like a really big store in Lancashire, they had queues around the block for their tripe food, and like their flagship store could seat 200 people. Like, this was a big deal.
You know, there was a rumor going around a long time ago that calamari that you bought in the store was actually made of pigs' rectums, and that they sliced it, the rings, and it has a very similar texture. You know, it's kind of that chewy, you know, thing that I...
Ken, have you eaten a pig's rectum?
Well, andouillette, I mean, you know.
Knowingly. No, I found that same rumour. There was an investigation by This American Life, and the journalists couldn't really find any definite proof, but they did try cooking up some calamari, like from a squid, and also some pig bung, as it's known. And it'd been very well cleaned because otherwise it tasted poo. And like the blind taste tests among his friends and colleagues, they couldn't tell the difference. So it's sort of allegedly, but it could well be.
Is there any one way to find out? I think maybe my favourite thing about tripe, which I read, was another friend of the pod, Mrs. Beaton, recommends using like the tripe cooking liquid to cure acne in teenagers.
Does it work?
They lose all their friends and then it doesn't matter what they look like.
Exactly. Who needs self-confidence when your face smells like tripe? It is time for our final lunchbox, and today that is you, Jack.
I have brought karta, which is Kazakh horse rectum.
Oh, God.
And again, we should be thankful that we're not in the same country, let alone the same room. I would love to try it because you have to try everything once, and I approach this with no judgment, but Kazakhstan has the highest consumption of horse meat per head of any country. They also love sheep's head broth and various other bits of offal. But basically, karta looks like calamari rings, although it's unspiced, pan-fried, usually, and it's horse rectum. There's no two ways about it. You have to boil it for 2.5 hours to remove most of the smell of poo. But apparently, the main draw is the texture, because even if it doesn't taste particularly exciting, because crispy on the outside, but tender on the inside, and there's a little membrane as well. So it's more about the sort of cultural thing, which I think is getting lost in most of Western society, is all about the mouthfeel and the interesting textures that you can get. I've read so much about how karta is like unique in its texture, and I'd love to try some.
Ken, have you tried?
Things like it. Yeah, sort of. The people who come from the steppes often eat their animals, in entirety. And I was in Hungary just this last fall, and these people who come from the steppes, the Kuman, settled in Hungary and stayed there. And I was at this conference where they took us to an ethnographic museum in Szentere, and this guy was there cooking us lunch, a huge cauldron, and they said, there's an entire sheep in there. And I thought, well, what do you mean? And then they said, yes, it's the skin, the bones, the head. And the guy pulled up the head with its teeth gleaming on it and everything. And it was hot. And he put some on my plate. And then he put more. And then he takes a big hunk of the face and puts it in there. And I said, I have to eat it, obviously, as a guest. And it wasn't really even seasoned either. It was just like, salt. Right. But that's very typical of the steppes everywhere from Siberia all the way through, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan. Mm-hmm. Is you milk the animals and then you eat the whole thing when it gets old.
Well, they're relatively recently nomadic, so the population kind of understands, nose to tail eating. I read that the Kazakhs also enjoy horse's neck lard. They often cook with it, and their own version of haggis called guirdak.
Ooh. Wow.
Sounds great.
I like it.
A meat stew cooked with offal. But yeah, this basically, I wanted to talk about different cultures around the world and their approach to offal, because we find the idea of horse rectum pretty gross. But, in Britain, we eat a lot of sausages, and there's a lot of pig bung in sausages, actually.
Wait, like in the actual sausage meat? Yeah. It's ground up?
Ground up into the sausage meat. Because it's a no-brainer if you're sort of cutting costs and throwing away bits of food.
So, what's really funny, though? I think if you look around the world, there are some cultures that really value their traditions. The Chinese, for example, the Italians. And they tend not to want foreign food. They tend to eat only what they've always done. And they still eat offal. They're still very much into organ meats and textures and things that were traditionally made. So they almost never forget foods. But the industrial West, with a few exceptions, we want things that are new, and we want things that are easier to eat and softer, and things that don't require a lot of cutting up, and things you can put in your hands and eat, hamburgers and pizza and stuff. Yes. And I think those specific cultures are the ones that will not eat offal anymore, and have the highest percentage of vegetarians for ethical reasons also. But it's a fascinating difference in the attitude toward food. Damn. And countries that are made up of immigrants and completely uprooted from the land where those traditions grew up, they're the first people to whatever's new, we'll eat it.
But Do you not have this thing when you're eating and there are lots of bones in it, or like lots of things you need to eat around? But sometimes I just want to eat my food. Like, I don't want to have to navigate like the danger zone of...
Well, but it's also sort of infantilizing the food, you know, to just say, oh, I'm only eating the muscle. It's just a waste. It's a waste sometimes of the best parts. It's the nuggetization of our food supply, you know. Food should not be recognizable, should not taste strange, should be slightly sweet also. That's the other weird thing. I'm not saying chicken nuggets don't taste good. They do. But it's got gastronomic consequences, I think. Even apart from the ethics and the environment, I think there's a lot of things that really taste great that fussy people just don't eat anymore because it grosses them out.
I was just going to move on to another country. France. They absolutely love their offal. Have you heard of canard à la presse?
It's a whole duck, right? It's that you put inside and you wrench it down and then the blood drips out and that makes a great sauce. Yeah.
You asphyxiate the duck so that you don't lose any of the blood. And then you partially roast it. Its liver is removed and the breast cut off. And the remaining carcass is put in a big ornate press. And sometimes they wheel it to your table. Yep. And it's made of like pewter or something. It's very beautiful, very ornate. And they squeeze the carcass, the blood and the bones. I mean, sorry if you're listening and you've got a little near the repugnance threshold. I'm sorry if I pushed you over. But they squeeze all the blood and the bone marrow seeps out into liquid form. And they make a sauce with it, with butter and cognac. And then they pour it over the duck. Which I think is, well, it's obviously very showy, but it's actually one of the many dishes served at the Three Emperors dinner. Have you heard of this from 1867? Which hilariously only had one emperor at, but there were the three rulers of Russia, Prussia and Germany. And the German one was Otto von Bismarck, who's the most famous of the three. It was 9,000 euros a head in today's money. They had it in Paris, and it was basically designed to be as decadent as it could be. It was 16 courses, and it lasted 8 hours. And one of the things they cooked is duck à la presse. And they also had ortolan bunting. Have we talked about that? It's actually illegal now in France, but it was basically a small songbird. Oh, Ken, you can talk about it maybe.
Yeah, so it's an ortolan. It's a tiny little bird which is fattened, and usually on figs, I think. And then when you roast it, you put a cover over your head while you're eating it, I guess to capture the aromas as you're eating this whole thing.
Well, the folk tale is that you're hiding your shame from God, so God can't see you're doing. Speaking of French dishes and eating all the bones, have you heard of pied de porc sans menehoul? Basically, pig trotters bound in cheesecloth and then boiled for 40 hours in white wine and herbs. So they become so tender that you can eat the whole thing, with including the bones. And supposedly it was so good that in 1791, when Louis XVI was fleeing the French Revolution, basically, he was fleeing arrest. He was on his way east towards Austria, and he just had to stop off at the town, after which the dish is named Saint-Menehoul, to sample it. And apparently he and his retinue were spotted and arrested the next day. But who knows, maybe if he didn't want to try this pig trotter dish, he would never have been caught. And the butterfly effect of that moment, you know, the French would still be a monarchy, and who knows?
Yeah.
Ken, I wonder if you've ever eaten in America, they're known as prairie oysters, Montana tenderloins, cowboy caviar.
So my next door neighbor, his wife's family owns a ranch, and every now and then he'll help them castrate the bulls. And one year he came back with a big bucket of testicles and said, here, you cook these. And I did. And they were lovely. But the funniest thing is another neighbor, a little boy, scarfed them down. He was just like, this is the best thing I've ever eaten. You have to peel them, which is really disconcerting because you're holding these balls and pulling the thing off. And then you bread them and fry them. And it just tastes like giblets. There's nothing strange about it at all. They used to be a really popular garnish. If you go into like late 17th century cooking, they would make big pies and things or salads or anything and garnish them with testicles and coxcombs and artichokes offal was a great garnish for them because it was decorative and you could imagine Baroque aesthetic.
I mean, the testicle look, I'm not buying that as a beautiful garnish, but the coxcomb, I'm like, that is fair. To wrap up, should we talk a little bit about the future of offal? Because we've spoken about how it's fallen out of favor. One of the things I loved reading about was the kind of renaissance of offal in the UK in the 90s that was in part inspired by chefs like Fergus Henderson, like this big trendy push for nose to tail eating. And also this kind of shift in the cultural capital and the status. In the 90s, offal started to become, and I would argue is more so now, like quite a hipster, trendy and expensive way to eat.
It's not going to be much longer. You know, if you look at the way trends go, there are periods in history that really trust science and technology and anything ultra processed. And I think we're about to enter into one of those periods. The generation now, they're not bothered by that in a way that, say, my generation definitely was. And for those periods that want traditional, organic, local, hipster pickles, as I like to call them, you know, I think it's on the way out. I think we're politically changing and economically, and people have gotten tired of artisanal food. I think if you give it another, you know, 25 years, we'll come back around to, you know, prizing offal again. But on the immediate horizon, I can't imagine it's going to grow in popularity.
I think it will become an artisanal food. And also, it is an easy way to sort of reduce your carbon footprint.
Hopefully, we have managed to convince some of our listeners to dabble. Kent, do you have any recommendations for, like, a good place to start? Like, is there a dish?
Sure. I would say start with a heart. There's two ways to cook it. You either slice it, throw it on the grill, and serve it. And people will say, lovely steak. They will not know that it's because it's just muscle. Or you stew it for a long, long time, and it becomes soft, and it gets a texture that's really lovely. That's a good entry point, I think.
That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
Yes, and you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions by emailing us, lunchbox@qi.com.
Ken, where can people follow you and your work? What have you got going on at the moment?
Well, I'm on Facebook and Instagram. I've got an atlas of fermented foods and drinks that should be coming out soon from University of California Press. And what I've been working on the past year or so is a series for the great courses called Forgotten Foods. So that's why I've been thinking about offal as a forgotten food.
Nice. Thank you so much for joining us, Ken. That was absolutely fascinating. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers and me, Manu Onrio, with special guest Ken Albala. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.